Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, April is a notorious month for genocide and mass human rights abuses. We'll analyze the forces of genocide and the means of preventing future genocide. But first, the great promise of the internet to offer interconnectedness and the spread of great ideas has also brought great challenges in discerning fact from fiction. Our next guest discusses the ways that we can identify misinformation and disinformation. Damaso Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information literacy. An experienced journalist, his specialties include providing professional development training for educators and journalists around the world, teaching them how to better understand the misinformation landscape and spot and fight against disinformation. Welcome, Damaso Reyes. It's great to have you here with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to start about the scope of the problem today with false information, conspiracy theories, so-called fake news. Do we have kind of an idea in terms of maybe quantifying it or some way of understanding how bad it really is?
I think the scope of the problem is, let's step back for a moment and think about the scope of social media. Social media, as we know it, Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, didn't exist 20 years ago. That's how short the cycle and transformation has been. But Facebook now has over 2 billion active users. In just a very short amount of time, we've seen a pretty significant transformation in our lifetimes, in less than one generation. We've seen a transformation in how people access and communicate information in a pretty significant way around the world. So if you think about the amount of time that most of us spend online in New Zealand, the figures that I've seen are something about 4 to 5 hours a day active online in some respect. So that's kind of the fertile ground when we talk about misinformation and disinformation. So from what we've seen and what we know, let's use the 2016 U.S. presidential cycle as an example, since for many people, that's kind of the starting point of their awareness of the scope and extent of misinformation. We know about 30 million people shared, the vast majority of them unwittingly, some form of disinformation was created by the Internet Research Agency or another Russian proxy. So that's 30 million. Now, that's just the people who shared it. Now, obviously, when somebody shares something on Facebook, other people see it. So maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20, maybe 100 if it's a particularly popular post. So we know that at least from that particular disinformation campaign, tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people were exposed to misinformation or this particular brand of misinformation. And then when we look in our daily lives, when we sort of look at what becomes popular, what trends, we know that false information, misinformation spreads about 6 times faster than correct information. And it can reach the most popular misinformation posts on Facebook, for example, can reach up to 100,000 people. That's each post. So the scope of the problem is pretty significant. It's not everywhere all the time, but it's pretty insidious.
There are lots of different types of misinformation, video manipulation, sort of half-truths, fake profiles, bots, intimidation. How do you sort of categorize these? And is there sort of a sliding scale in terms of what to be most concerned about?
I think we should be concerned about all of it, in part because it all kind of pollutes the information ecosystem, right? Some of it is, very obvious and sometimes very scary. But what the goal of creating disinformation and misinformation is for a lot of the entities and agents and people who do it is to really erode our information ecosystem, erode our ability to communicate with each other, to have a civil discourse, to be able to know what to believe, to be able to trust in information. So all information or misinformation in that case is actually fairly dangerous. So we do have, very broadly speaking, a number of different categories. And one thing that I think it's really important to address early on is this concept or this term fake news. And we really want to retire it because it's become this kind of catch-all pejorative term that's kind of lost all meaning. So it's not particularly useful to talk about fake news since it's such a loaded term now. But we can talk about categories of misinformation and disinformation. So we have things like manipulated content. So when we see something, let's say a picture of a famous celebrity or athlete, and they're wearing a t-shirt which espouses a political cause that they never wore. That's an example of manipulated content. Some of the content is real, but it's been altered a little bit. We see fabricated content. We see things which are photoshopped completely. Deepfakes are an example of fabricated content. These are computer-generated videos of celebrities or famous people, and you know they're saying things that they never said or doing things that they never did. We have things like false context. So we might have a photograph or a graphic that is real, it's not been altered, but the context in which it appears is false. So it seems to lend credibility to a false claim that we might see on Instagram or Twitter. So those are some of the many different kinds of misinformation, and they all have slightly different techniques, different tactics that they use to get at us. But underlying all of this is this idea that many of the people who create misinformation, they're trying to target our emotional centers. They're trying to trigger us emotionally. They're trying to make us fearful. They're trying to make us angry. They're trying to make us worried or concerned. And by doing so, they're hoping that they can override our ability to think critically. And then we just share the information. And that's how the misinformation propagates. And that's really what we're trying to combat and what we're most concerned about. We're trying to get people to take a pause, take a beat, think about whether or not what they're about to share is actually real. And if they have any question, any doubt, we want them to not share it, because then that prevents it from propagating.
Before we get into some of the ways people can identify what might be misinformation or disinformation, let's talk about the consequences. So you mentioned eroded trust and an eroded ecosystem of information, inability to communicate civilly. What other consequences do you see from the proliferation of, you know, I would argue even, you know, these repetitive conspiracy theories that seem to be circulating quite a bit these days? How do you see that?
So we have these, you know, what some people might call these kind of abstract consequences. So the erosion of social cohesion or civil discourse, these are, you know, very big words. But what we're increasingly seeing is direct, specific harm that's being caused either to individuals or to groups. And what happens is that people get exposed to a piece of bad information. They believe it. They make a poor decision, which leads to a dangerous action. In New Zealand and in the region, we've actually had an example. There was an outbreak of measles in New Zealand, which in part was fostered by a spread of misinformation around vaccines and their efficacy and their risks associated with this. And in the United States, clearly we've been riding this way for quite some time, and it's spread all over the world now, unfortunately. And so vaccination rates declined over a course of years, and there was a measles outbreak. Now, fortunately, New Zealand has an excellent healthcare system, and fortunately, nobody died. But there were children and people who were sickened and put in danger. That's a real consequence. And tragically, that measles outbreak was then exported to Samoa. And they don't have the same kind of robust medical infrastructure, but unfortunately, they were also exposed to a lot of the same mis and disinformation around vaccines. And not just the misinformation, there was a series of events which led to a lowering, a quite rapid lowering of vaccination rates among young people and children. And tragically, over 80 people died last year, many of them young children, because they were infected with measles. And the truth is that measles is a very dangerous disease, especially if you're a young person, especially if you don't have the kind of robust supportive care you might find in a place like New Zealand or Auckland. So misinformation has real-world consequences. It can lead to people dying. Certainly in other parts of the world, we've seen in India and Pakistan, misinformation being used against ethnic minority groups, often being spread via WhatsApp or other social media. The trope is that a specific member of a social minority group has been seen or accused of committing some kind of sexual violence against the majority group, woman or girl. And so then that spreads, people get together and they decide to attack or even murder that person. We've seen examples of this, many examples of this, unfortunately, over the past few years. So far from being theoretical, misinformation causes real world harm that we can directly see and directly measure. And it seems to be increasing.
Ordinary people are pretty busy and have, you know, work and school and kids and all of these types of things. How can they know or identify or screen out misinformation?
So I think it's really important to actually challenge this idea a little bit, because I hear it a lot. And I think about my own social media habits and information gathering habits and those of the people I know. Oftentimes, I'll be at work during the middle of the day, and I'll see friends of mine posting lots of stuff on social media. And I'm thinking to myself, aren't you at work? The truth is, we actually have a lot of time. We spend a lot of time on social media. Question is, what do we think is a good use of our time, right? And so we haven't been socialized and we haven't been taught that verifying information, questioning information is actually a good use of our time. So there's a bit of behavior modification that I think needs to happen. We need to start thinking about the consequences of accidentally sharing misinformation and why we have a social responsibility to ensure that the information we share is real and is accurate. There are a couple of, you know, relatively simple techniques that we can use to, if not verify information, certainly help prevent the spread of misinformation. And so the first thing that we should do is when we come across a piece of information, we should ask ourselves, what's the source of this information? So is the person sharing it the person who created it? Or are they sharing something that somebody else has created or that somebody else is sharing? Can we figure out who the original person is who shared it? And what do we know about this person or this entity or this group? Are they transparent? Do we know who they are? Are they hiding? Are they anonymous? Once we figured out who shared it or who created it, what else do they share? Do they share a lot of things that seem like they might be conspiracy theories or seem like they might not make a lot of sense? That could be a sign that, you know what, this might be false information or this might be misinformation too. So maybe that's 5, 10, 15 seconds into the process, right? You know, we're getting maybe yellow lights, maybe not a red light yet. When I look at the information, do I have a strong emotional reaction to it? Am I angry? Am I sad? Am I fearful? Sort of disproportionately? Does it make me want to act? Does it make me want to share because I'm operating from a very emotional place? If that's the case, that's kind of a red flag that you may be being emotionally manipulated. And so you should really take a beat here, because accurate information, fact-based information, shouldn't be emotionally manipulative. You might sort of get intellectually concerned, or you might say, hey, there's some injustice happening here, but it shouldn't make you want to punch a wall or make you fearful for what's around the corner. And often misinformation is specifically trying to target our emotional centers in the hope of overriding our ability to think critically. And then we keep going, right? 30, 35 seconds in, we start asking ourselves, well, what are the claims that are being made by this piece of information? Do they offer any evidence, or are they just making an outrageous claim, right? Oftentimes we see misinformation. It makes a claim. It provides no sources, no evidence. So if something makes a claim and it provides no evidence, if it says something like 70% of highly intelligent people eat chocolate, According to whom? What's your source? Is there a study? Does anybody corroborate this? And if they do provide a link or do provide an evidence, well, that's an opportunity to look it up. You know, we're 45, 50 seconds in. Let's do a quick Google search. Does chocolate make you smarter? And let's see if we can actually find any standards-based sources which replicate this claim. So those are some of the very simple things. Again, in sort of less than a minute, we can, if not verify a claim, we can certainly see if more questions are raised. And if more questions are raised and we can't verify something, but maybe we can't totally debunk it, at that point, we should just say to ourselves, let's stop. Let's certainly not share it. By not sharing it, we've stopped the vector of transmission and we've thwarted the people who are creating this misinformation. Because remember, the people who create misinformation proportionally to the people who are on social media are actually quite small. So they require ordinary people, unwitting hosts, let's say, if we want to use the medical example, to share this misinformation. That's the only way that it can propagate. Bots can't propagate misinformation nearly as effectively as ordinary people. And that's something that, that data science is showing us quite well. They're the seeds and they often get something going, but it requires ordinary people in order for this misinformation to spread. So if we practice, internet or social media hygiene, we can actually stop this stuff from spreading.
What can we learn from places like Finland that are taking on teaching people while they're in school at a very young age what should be done to prevent sort of the widespread adaptation?
I think that what's great about these efforts is that we're seeing them take it extremely seriously. We're seeing countries begin to take this as a kind of national emergency, as seriously as making sure young people are vaccinated, or as seriously as they should be taking climate change. It really requires a fundamental rethinking of how we educate young people. And that rethinking has to be centered around critical thinking, not just absorbing information and being able to repeat it, you know, but really be able to critically assess information, being able to find sources of information, being able to independently analyze information and interpret it for other people. That's a different way of teaching than, you know, most of us learned in certainly in the 20th century. And it requires also retraining how we teach teachers. But this is how we're going to deal with this problem. It's not going to be a local municipality or even a province or a state. This really has to begin to be addressed on a national and a multinational level, because the problem doesn't respect borders. It doesn't respect language. You have, as we saw in 2016, young teenagers in Macedonia monetizing misinformation during the U.S. election cycle. Oftentimes, it's national governments that have the weight and have the money to begin to demand these sorts of reforms and to support educators and parents as they begin to address this issue.
You know, you bring up another really important point, which is the monetizing of information and the sort of what we would call the political economy of media, including Facebook and Google and whatever, the Macedonians, that whole idea of making money from either informing or misinforming or getting people emotional. And I would say there's a big scale, sort of a long spectrum of how that is done. And today there's the people who try to get our emotions by misinformation or by mischaracterizing or giving a narrative, as you said, that might get people to pay attention. But there's also the problem of paywalls. And so it becomes harder and harder to get good journalism.
I'd push back on that just a little bit. First, even in the land of paywalls, we have more free access to information than at any time in human history, certainly in any time in recent memory. The vast majority of information is still free and still accessible, at least to a limited extent. Usually the problem is not that people are doing their diligent search, and then they come up to a paywall, and then they give up. That's not at least what I'm seeing. I don't know what other researchers and experts in the field are seeing. But what we do need to do, and what we do need to acknowledge as a civil society, is that journalists need to be paid. You know, journalists work incredibly hard, and news organizations spend a lot of money verifying and doing this hard work. So how are we going to support that? There's an argument, perhaps, that some people might say that information wants to be free, that this sort of very important civic information needs to be free. Okay, if that's the case, how do we then support quality journalism? Are we asking the government to subsidize it? Are we asking philanthropists to subsidize it? I don't think there's any one model, but the truth is, whether it's in our everyday lives, getting a coffee, or the things we spend money on online, things like Netflix, people don't question whether or not they should pay for a Netflix or an iTunes subscription. They say, okay, well, I get value out of this. And I can't get this anywhere else unless you want to pirate or torrent, which the average person maybe doesn't have the technical skill or desire to do that. But they've sort of been after, you know, the Wild West days of the early internet where everything was free, people began to be accustomed to paying for entertainment. And now you have Apple TV and Netflix and Amazon Prime and all these things that are making significant amounts of money. We have to... And I say we, and I'm a journalist. Journalists need to make their case. We need to help the public understand that the information that we work so very hard to produce is worthy of paying for. And places like the New York Times have been very successful and made a lot of money doing that. But we haven't yet as a society changed our thinking, our behavior when it comes to news, that's worth paying for. We've largely done it when it comes to entertainment. And that shift has happened. But I think the next shift needs to be that we need to see this as a valuable resource.
So one of the things that has eroded over the last 30 years, particularly in the United States, is trust in journalism. And that has come from other types of media organizations that have potentially an economic benefit by targeting standard traditional ethical journalism. And then when you add the paywall to it, and I'm certainly not arguing that there's not a cost to producing good journalism, but I'm talking about a general information ecosystem that you brought up at the very beginning. So it's kind of a perfect storm in some ways, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's important to recognize is that journalism organizations, specifically corporations, did a really, really lousy job of monetizing the internet in the first 10 or 15 years of the 21st century. They were giving away internet ads as part of a bundle if you bought a print ad. They were really devaluing their own product and also giving it away for free. So you're training the consumer to expect that this is free and to value it that way. So the media organizations and corporations have a lot of blame to bear. But this erosion of trust, you know, it comes from a couple different directions. First of all, there are actors, for lack of a better word, who their goal is to erode that trust because they have their own agenda, or they want you to trust them and not trust someone who will maybe expose what they're doing. So that's one thing. Politicians can be guilty of this. There are state actors who have been trying to do this for generations, not just recently. The other thing is, you know, over the past 30 years, there's just been a tremendous amount of competition in the information game. When I was a school-aged kid, if something called itself news, I could trust that it had been created by a journalist for the purpose of informing me and checked by an editor. Now I have no such assurance. Lots of people calling themselves journalists, lots of things calling itself news. There's just more information out there than I ever had to deal with as a kid. So it's not just an erosion of trust. There's just more choice out there. And of course, the challenge is those other forms of information are targeting our emotional centers. They're targeting our biases. They're tailoring information to what we want to hear, not necessarily what we need to hear. And it's really hard to compete against that. And I think journalists obviously have a role. There's nothing wrong with proving why we're trustworthy. There's nothing wrong with being transparent about how we do our work. If anything, it makes people more passionate about our work, and it makes us seem more trustworthy than the other people out there creating mis- and disinformation who aren't being transparent.
Well, Dimasa Reyes, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Dimasa Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information literacy. When we come back, April is perhaps the most notorious month for victims of genocide. We'll analyze why genocides happen and how they might be prevented in the future. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. April has been a very dark month for victims of genocide. On April 24, 1915, Turkish authorities began their systematic annihilation of the Armenians in Turkey. On April 7, the Rwandan Hutu power government began exterminating the Tutsi population. In Cambodia, Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime launched its genocidal efforts on April 17. April was also the month that Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic began the Serb offensive to eliminate the Muslim communities in parts of Bosnia. Why does genocide happen, and how can it be prevented? With us are three experts. Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, Cambodia, the Eastern Zone Massacres, and the Pol Pot Regime, Race, Power, and Genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, 1975 to 1979. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide and editor of Genocide, Truth, Memory, and Representation, and Annihilating Difference, The Anthropology of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty, and 0 Degrees of Empathy. He's also editor of Understanding Other Minds and the Maladaptive Mind. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ben Kiernan. You've identified 4 primary factors or themes when you've looked across genocides, although you say each are unique. What would you say those primary themes or factors are?
Well, in terms of the mindset of the perpetrators of genocide, the people who later go on to commit genocide or implement genocidal policies, some of the preoccupations and ideas that surface early in their careers and seem to be pointers to their later actions include, for instance, racial hatred or religious prejudice. Obviously, that's part of the definition of genocidal violence against an ethnic or religious or national or racial group. But other factors in the mindset of perpetrators that I found coming up again and again over a long survey of several millennia of genocidal occurrences, not only the racial and religious prejudice, but also an expansionist drive to take over territory. And along with that, a ideological obsession with how the land should be used, not just taking it over and ruling it or even expelling or killing the indigenous population, but also the fact that the correct usage of that land, and it's often agricultural cultivation, and so this leads to a prejudice against urban dwellers or hunter-gatherers, neither of whom are farming populations. And in many cases, not all, genocidal perpetrators have a fetish about cultivation. And along with that, a fourth factor is the kind of obsession with the ancient past of the ethnic group of the perpetrators, which what I call a cult of antiquity, an idea that there was a glorious past that the modern-day perpetrators of genocide, in whatever era they might be in, they're looking back at a glorious past that they want to recapture. And that often has a philosophical connection with their ethnicity, the origins of their ethnic group, which they want to reclaim the glory days of. And it also has something to do with the territory they allegedly once occupied and committing genocide against so-called intruders or people who get in the way of reclaiming that territory and that ancient ethnic purity.
Even the ethnic wars that didn't turn completely genocidal had a component of, say, the greater Serbia or the greater Croatia, greater Bosnia. But those may have not been completely accurate.
Oh, yes, they're often mythical. Sometimes there's a kernel of truth or more than a kernel of truth. Sometimes they're just invented. But quite often there is a kind of irredentist claim that goes along with the expansionism in the sense that this was once our territory. On the other hand, these four factors, when they're together, that's racism, expansionism, the obsession with antiquity and cultivation, they're powerful and explosive as a mix, but sometimes in isolation, just one or even two of the factors don't produce a genocidal outcome. And that's important to note, that even discrimination may not be more than an obsession. It might not even be practiced, and therefore it cannot always lead to genocide. But in combination with a militaristic expansionism, for instance, racial prejudice can be extremely virulent.
Alex Hinton, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your studies?
I'm writing a book that focuses on Doik, who was the commandant of a prison camp in Cambodia, S21, which is now commonly known as Tuol Sleng. And I've sort of looked at three issues. One is, how does genocide come about? And Professor Kiernan has very nicely described a number of the key factors. The second thing is, how do people come to perpetrate acts of genocide and mass violence? And then I'm also looking now at notions of justice and the aftermath of conflict. From an anthropological perspective, I would look also at the way that difference is constructed. As Professor Kiernan was pointing out, that a genocidal regime will envision difference in a certain way so that people belong to the group, in-group, out-group. As it does so, usually the message, the ideological blueprint that they've devised, begins to resonate more with people in a context of socioeconomic upheaval. When a regime has come to power, typically they begin to manufacture differences that people might not otherwise be as aware of suddenly come into the foreground and are actually become linked to ideological messages and often structural messages, legal messages. So people begin to be differentiated in very specific sorts of ways.
Can you give some examples of those so people can understand?
So I'm going to talk about situations where genocide hasn't occurred, but the processes I'm talking about are all around us. With the events taking place in Boston, we have 9/11 is an example in the United States. Immediately in the aftermath of the bombing in Boston and then the seeking suspects, then two brothers have been located and they're being coded as Muslim and Chechenian or from somewhere in that region. Most people probably have never heard of Chechnya, and suddenly that identity is foregrounded. It's something people become aware of, and it becomes fixed and differentiated. It's an us-them differentiation. That's 9/11 with the perception of Muslims and Arab Americans. The same sort of thing went on. And in genocide, it's taken to the extreme. So you have differences in awareness of other sorts of beings through an identity position are foregrounded. They become marked. By this, I mean dehumanized in certain sorts of ways, stigmatized in society. And as part of the blueprint of the ideological regime, and I should just note on the side as well, what I'm talking about is particularly applicable to what are called ideological genocide, colonial genocides, for example. The other thing is then people are rounded up and often confined. They're marked as other, and then the process can begin of eliminating those people. You know, another way sometimes I think about it through the acronym BPERP. B is in belief, the ideological beliefs and the personal views of the perpetrators. The PER is the perspective of people, the way in which the others are defined by ideology and those messages are taken in by individual perpetrators. And the last P in BPERP is for position, and that's the person, the structural position the person occupies in the system and the position of the victim. And those three things interact over time, and the foregrounding of one of those three factors can be more prominent within a given context.
One other aspect that you had done in your work pertained to the psychosocial phenomena like honor, what you called face. How do these come into play honor particularly seems like it would be a contradiction to genocide, but you found them intertwined in some way.
Absolutely. One of the things that often emerges in explanations of mass violence and especially genocide is the notion that there's no meaning to it, it's meaningless. On a radio station, there was a student in Boston who said, there's no logic to this. There is a logic. There are sets of cultural understandings that inform action. One of the things that a perpetrator regime will need to do as they envision difference, when they're envisioning difference, is they need to cast their ideology, in the case of the Khmer Rouge, for example, Marxist-Leninism, was extreme in a way that people on the ground are going to understand. So if you're trying to appeal to peasants who don't have a great degree of formal education but may have been educated in the pagoda, as was the case, these terms are taken and molded and adapted so that they're going to resonate with local conceptions. Among the things that perpetrator regime may play upon are notions of status, which is linked to honor, face. People often think of genocide and mass murder as if there are these maniacal ideologues who come about and manipulate a bunch of followers who blindly do whatever they say, but it's much more complicated than that. It's actually difficult to try and motivate people to do things that otherwise go against at least some of their beliefs, and this is a struggle that many perpetrator regimes have to deal with, and it changes through time, and sometimes it leads to the downfall of the group.
Simon Baron-Cohen, let's bring you in. You've been looking at the psychological basis of cruelty, of evil. You've identified a missing component among people who perpetrate these things, and that is empathy. How does it happen that people fail to either develop empathy or that develop the loss of empathy?
The points that Ben and Alex have made sit very comfortably within the framework of empathy. They've really been highlighting social factors that can lead an individual to lose their empathy in certain situations. Ben was talking about racism as one of his four factors. If the propaganda around racism is potent enough, you can lose your empathy for the other person, the person in the out-group. And Alex was talking about a very social, psychological perspective, in-group, out-group relations, that often when a racist propaganda is being created, the out-group will be described in very dehumanized language so that the in-group have reduced empathy for members of the out-group. And I think we saw that in genocides like Rwanda, where the propaganda was describing one ethnic group as subhuman, and you know, once you no longer see the person as a person, but see them as a subhuman or an object, then of course you become capable of treating them as an object. And I think that the missing component in the discussion so far is about the brain. I'm a neuroscientist, and what we've seen in recent research is a greater understanding of the brain basis of empathy. And what you can see when you image the brain whilst the individual is looking at somebody else and responding to someone else's emotions is that we all vary in how much empathy we have and in how much the empathy circuit in the brain is activated, for example, if we see somebody else in distress. So there are individual differences in empathy, and it may be some of those social, psychological factors, in-group, out-group relations, racism, you know, these kinds of things. For some individuals, it'll be enough to push them even lower down that empathy bell curve so that they become capable of hurting another person.
So what you're saying is that empathy can actually be turned off.
That's right. I mean, there are individual differences in empathy. There are different ways of measuring it, either using questionnaires or other kinds of psychological tests. And what you find is that some people have a lot of empathy, some people have just average amounts, and some people are starting off much lower, below average. But then there are situational factors that can make an individual have more or less empathy in a given situation. And, you know, when we try to make sense of why some people lose their empathy or fail to develop it in the first place, we have to look at both individual factors, for example, their genetics, their biology, but also these social factors.
I think two things arise from that. One is, on a mass level, How can empathy be erased? Is that what psychologists talk about when they talk about mob behavior or intergroup emotions that comes into play? And can empathy then be turned on for those people who may have previously had it shut off?
Both questions are really good. You know, the first one about crowd behavior. If you're in a group and you feel under threat, it's going to be hard to sustain your empathy for those who you believe are threatening you. So if the propaganda is telling you that the other group is about to attack, about to invade, they're about to even attack your family, you have a very primitive reaction biologically. Your cortisol hormone increases to get you ready for fight or flight. And in that condition, in that state, it's much harder to remember or to stay focused on the other person's feelings. All you want to do is defend yourself and defend those who you love. Whereas in other conditions, for example, peace or post-genocide, if there's a kind of reconciliation process where you come face-to-face with the victim, your empathy could recover, where you begin to see the person, as a victim, with all of their subjectivity.
We certainly saw a little bit of that in South Africa during the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. It wasn't a genocide per se, but some horrible human rights conditions. Alex Hinton, let me bring you back in for just a moment, because this sort of ties to what you called psychosocial dissonance. What is that, and how is it related to genocidal activity?
No, that's very relevant to the discussion. The notion of psychosocial dissonance speaks to Festinger's notion of cognitive dissonance, but places it into a socio-cultural context. So in other words, if people have different belief structures and they're brought into tension, it creates a dissonance. So one obvious thing that takes place in situations of mass violence and genocide is that most people then socialize not to kill or harm other human beings in one sense, but then they're put in a context where they're told that, for example, these aren't really human beings, they're evil enemies, microbes, viruses, so on and so forth. And that goes back to the marking of difference. But there's still a tension that someone still, in some sense, may or may not see a human being. And if they see them that way and they're told they're an enemy and need to be killed, it may create a dissonance, a tension within them that needs to be resolved. And there are a number of different cognitive steps they can take. I think empathy is absolutely critical, as are other emotions like shame, and findings from neuroscience, psychopathology is directly relevant. But I'm a little bit wary that there's a tendency for things to become overly biologized and for people to give primacy to something. And I'm not saying that Simon is doing this. I'm saying that it's something that exists with many people, where people want to look for the genetic roots of different things. And I think there's a danger that if that factor, which can be relevant in different ways, is taken and given primacy, it can then divert our attention from absolutely key social, cultural, and historical factors that are operative. And I sort of just put that caveat in. So it's not to disagree with Simon, but to say that for people who are listening, that we do have this cultural bias that exists in our society where we like to biologize things. And in terms of understanding genocide and mass violence, it's important not to have that come in and frame our understanding, or we'll lose sight of other important factors.
But rather just to understand that these are all contributors, and they're all things that we need to understand together as a construction of what we see in the world.
Absolutely. There are certain ways in which myths like Lord of the Flies, where you have this notion that people can have civilization, but they're brought, these kids go to this island, and suddenly the veneer of civilization is removed and people are acting upon their baser evolved instincts. So we have these ways of thinking that float around, and again, there are ways in which factors linked to biology and evolution, emotion, neuropsychology are all relevant, but it jives with what people tend to think with their common folk understandings. I think that's an important caveat to put in there.
A quick reminder, this is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the forces of genocide. There have been a number of genocides that have remained either unacknowledged or under-acknowledged or flat-out denied. Ben Kiernan, you've written about Native Americans. There's the Armenian genocide in Australia, considerable denial of what happened with the Aborigines people. First of all, remind us of what did occur, and then give us a sense of what the cost is of unacknowledgement, under-acknowledgement, or flat-out denial.
I would just like to quickly refer to what both Simon and Alex were just saying, if I could, because they both made a lot of sense to me. Alex talking about the broader historical factors and Simon talking about empathy and the different gradations of empathy amongst different people. And I think that makes it hard for genocidal groups to recruit in normal situations. And what happens is that they tend to only thrive in the conditions of historical and social upheaval. War, massive destabilization, economic upheaval. In the Cambodian case, it was the massive intrusion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia and the widespread bombing that took place. And that enabled the Khmer Rouge to recruit supporters, but they also had to work on the existing empathy of many of those supporters by telling them who to attack and who was responsible for the bombing and so on. And they deliberately did that in telling the population they were recruiting, whose villages had been bombed and whose families had been uprooted, that they were being attacked not by the United States Air Force, but by the Phnom Penh population, the capital city, and the population there. And that turned a lot of the violence of the attacked peasantry against the cities. In terms of the number of genocides that have occurred in the 20th century, sometimes these are disguised or hidden behind wars. So it's often thought in some cases that such and such a genocide was not a genocide but a civil war. Often both are going on. They're not necessarily one or the other, but overlapping factors. One of the things that genocide studies and the field has uncovered over the last 50 years or so, particularly since the work of Raphael Lemkin, who really began this in the 1940s and was instrumental in having the Genocide Convention become international law, is that there were a large number of cases in history, and indeed since the Genocide Convention has become law, of genocide breaking out. Now, one of those that was for long not given the attention that it deserved was the genocide in Guatemala, for which a former president of Guatemala is actually the first former head of state in the Americas to face trial for genocide. And the destruction of indigenous populations in Guatemala in the 1980s is still an event that hasn't got the attention that it deserves. I think it's true of many indigenous cases. Not all colonial or conquests of indigenous peoples led to genocide, but a number of them did, both in the Australian continent and in North America and Central and South America as well. And the genocide in Guatemala only 30 years ago is a kind of reflection of one of the worst cases of that.
In terms of people who dissent or try to stop genocidal activity, what can we learn from them? So I'll start with Alex.
I also wanted to return to your question about genocides that are out of focus, because I think it taps into a key thread that's emerging within the field of genocide studies. Some people have referred to it as critical genocide studies, and one part would be sort of informed by the Frankfurt School and critical theory, but another part focuses more on sort of destabilizing the tacit presuppositions of the field and the categories that lead us to look at things in certain sorts of ways. Just briefly, there has, for a long time, in some sense, been a model of genocide that's informed by the Holocaust, with Auschwitz being the, through metonymy, standing for sort of epitomizing what genocide is. And I think that informed the UN Genocide Convention. And linked to this, people often talk about referring to some cases of mass violence as genocide, saying, well, if we call too many things genocide, it will dilute the meaning of the term. I call this the dilution metaphor, and it's sort of a gatekeeping metaphor and one that has ontological resonance in the sense that we all know what an impurity is and it's something that we're familiar with, but there's no reason why we shouldn't necessarily, if cases fit a definition, refer to them as genocide. So it's this gatekeeping notion. And I think a real shift in genocide studies has been that people are starting to look at a much larger range of cases. You know, at the center I direct, we recently had a conference, and there's a volume coming out called Hidden Genocides. Another scholar has a book called Forgotten Genocides. Ben has the volume that's been really critical in this move of sort of looking at the broad historical purview of genocide in a variety of different contexts and probably, as you know, the foundational text. This has been a big shift to look at these sort of cases that are off the map that we haven't looked at because we have certain sorts of biases and preconceptions.
Knowing what we know psychologically, neurologically, sociologically, politically, Simon Baron-Cohen, what can we do to prevent genocide?
Just before I move to that question, the previous question was about hidden genocides or genocides that are off the radar. And I just wanted to mention that it's the anniversary, as we know, of the Armenian genocide. And it's just an opportunity for your listeners to, if they don't know about it, to go and read about it and learn about it. This is the Turkish Holocaust, it might be called, against the Armenians back in 1915 when Turkey constructed 25 concentration camps just outside of Turkey's border in Syria, with resulting huge numbers of Armenians being killed. So we just need to remember some of these other Holocausts that don't get the media attention that, for example, the Nazi Holocaust did and does. And to me, this reminds me that the risk of genocide is in every culture. It's not about a specific culture, and maybe that's the kind of link to prevention, that if we can identify, as Alex started out doing, some of the factors that together make a very potent risk and start to educate people to watch out for these things in certain situations, that might be one step towards prevention. That when the media and when governments are using propaganda, history can show us that we can easily fall for it, but equally once the analysis is laid out, you can then reflect, and that might be one step to guard against just succumbing to the impact of propaganda.
Ben Kiernan?
Along with the hidden genocides, there are also the hidden rescues, indeed the hidden rescuers and the hidden resistance. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Marcy Shore, which talks about the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and she actually makes the point that although in some ways it was a hopeless cause, it did delay for several months the deportations from Warsaw to Auschwitz. We need to give more attention to the people who rescued victims or resisted and in fact inflicted casualties on the perpetrators and perhaps delayed or even offset or reduced the number of victims. That's one of the ways to look at prevention, is to study what it is that makes rescue possible and what kinds of people respond to requests to rescue or hide or otherwise shelter or help potential victims. One of the other aspects of genocide, at least as known in the public arena, is the lack of information about resistance. There were, in many cases, resistance movements that sprung up against genocide perpetrators and their regimes, whether it was in Bangladesh or East Timor or Cambodia or under the Nazi Holocaust or elsewhere. The people who try to prevent on the spot the deportation or murder of genocide victims really deserve more attention than they've got.
And Alex Hinton.
I agree with my colleague. I would just add that critical self-reflection is an absolutely key thing, because many of the dynamics that are taken to the extreme in genocide are around us all of the time. Peer pressure is just an example, bullying, so on and so forth. Awareness of what's occurred in general through educational initiatives enhances the awareness of what potential exists in different societies and how genocide sometimes can come on fairly quickly. In other cases, it has a much longer duration. The notion that Simon foregrounded of empathy, I think, is absolutely critical. And from my anthropological frame, I would also sort of cast that in terms of this notion of understanding how we envision difference in different sorts of ways, how difference is crystallized, but to come to try and understand other people as opposed to readily going along with whatever ways difference is being catalyzed. And certainly in Boston, that's something that's being debated, and even though, again, that's not a case of genocide, but that dynamic is one that you find taken to the extreme in genocide. Another key factor is international apathy, where people just don't care, or it's not a quote-unquote strategic priority and people don't pay attention to it. I might conclude by noting that, in a sense, genocide prevention always fails, because if there's ever a successful genocide prevention, we'll never know.
You mentioned the international apathy. Do you think that the move towards tribunals and the International Criminal Court are having an impact on reducing either a full-out genocide or at least the kinds of mass human rights abuses that we have seen?
I think people's common folk perceptions. Our ways of understanding is that, yes, if you bring people to justice, it will fight impunity and act as a deterrence. And there's certainly some truth to that. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to just say, oh, we have this one thing and it will always work. That's one among a number of factors that need to be attended to. And in some ways, it's one that is often foregrounded. So it's great that we have these initiatives to have justice. Been the case, you know, in some of the cases, like Guatemala or Cambodia right now, Argentina, the question immediately arises, why did it take so long to get to this point? So all the events that occurred during those years beforehand, they're historical events, political events, and they're questions that need to be asked about why it is that only now we're getting at this moment in time. It's not to say it's not good that we have it, but I think by only focusing on what's going on with the tribunals, we erase other things that may be directly relevant, including, for example, geopolitics.
One of the things we didn't talk about was the legitimation of political violence in certain circumstances. And let me just do a final comment. Simon Baron-Cohen?
One point made earlier, I think by Alex, was that we shouldn't let biology take any primacy. And I would agree with that, that whether we're taking a sociological or anthropological or a biological approach, none of these have primacy. They're all just contributing factors in the mix.
And Ben Kiernan.
Absolutely. Multi-pronged prevention is the only way to go. I think it's the Human Security Report, sponsored by the UN, came up with the conclusion that the number of genocides has slightly decreased in the late 90s and in the 21st century, and that may have something to do with the first international criminal tribunals for both Bosnia and Rwanda. But also, I think it's got something to do with the end of the Cold War, or more importantly, perhaps an awareness that conflict has to be avoided, that there needs to be attention given to not starting new wars, that there needs to be attention given to resolution of poverty and other historical and social problems that allow genocidal perpetrators to recruit supporters. I think that's absolutely key.
Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work. Alex Hinton, Ben Kiernan, Simon Baron-Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty and 0 Degrees of Empathy. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.